and use these money on non-market housing that is affordable, secure, and safe. Housing justice becomes possible when the government stops subsidizing Canadian mining companies who plunder and commit human rights violations in other countries. There is money in housing. It should be put in housing, not anywhere else. We believe that housing justice will not happen with increasing housing rents, no living wages, no increase in social assistance and housing subsidies, especially for our poor community members and people with disabilities. Displacement and housing justice do not go together, and here in Vancouver, we are witness to worsening homelessness. In our very own community, decent housing is well beyond the reach of our Filipino working class and migrant community. The social costs of housing injustice are huge. Without appropriate housing, integration, employment, recovery from mental illness or disabilities, escaping violence, and so on, are often not possible. We see this with our newly arrived Filipino families who are trying to settle in the city and rebuild their lives after being separated under the Live-In Caregiver Program. Many live in shared homes, crowded basements, and many are forced to move out of the city when housing becomes unaffordable. Working multiple jobs to be able to pay rent is an everyday reality. We believe that housing is a human right, and when housing is denied or kept well beyond the reach of people so they can live decent lives, then that is a violation of human right. We stand in solidarity with our fellow working class and poor communities to demand the Canadian government make housing that is affordable, secure, and safe for all a priority.
Find the full version of this podcast, along with Ivan Drury's powerful closing talk and a following Q&A under special broadcasts on the CITR site at citr.ca. Stay tuned for 2 more hours in recognition of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence.
I'm going away. Look into my eyes. Last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. I want you here with me at the Wise Hall, please. Wise Hall, please.
Tune in every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. for A Little Bit of Soul with your host, Jade Puck. Little Bit of Soul plays primarily old recordings of jazz, swing, big band, blues, oldies, and Motown.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
You are about to hear an excerpt from a recording at the Remedy Readings. You can hear the full recording online at citr.ca under special broadcasts. The Remedy is a book of queer and trans voices on health and healthcare. To quote from the book's press kit, "The Remedy means to heal, to cure, to set right, to make reparations." This recording, split in two halves, contains live readings from 6 of the Remedy's contributors, including an introduction from the Remedy's editor, Zina Sharman. If you'd like to listen to or download this podcast, you can find it online under our special broadcast page at citr.ca/radio/special-broadcast. To purchase The Remedy, you can go to arsenalpulp.com.
It's very weird and exciting that this is real and happening because this book has been in the works for over 2 years. So, I know. It's like, it's the thing. It's why I'm drinking my water bottle with my rescue remedy in it right now. The other remedy. Thank you, naturopath. So I really want to thank all of you for being here. This book is... It is such a gift from the community of people who came together to create it. There are 30 writers who are part of the Remedy. A number of them are here tonight, and you'll get to hear their amazing words. And it also is a gift to the community from all of us. Really so excited to welcome up our next reader, Chase Willier. Chase is a Nihia from Saddle Lake Cree Nation and Sucker Creek First Nation in Alberta. He was part of the 60s Scoop and grew up in the Silks Nation, where he was traditionally adopted. Chase spent 30 years in the RCMP working with First Nations as a Two-Spirit woman before he retired and transitioned. He is presently writing his memoir and is happily married with a new baby girl. Please give a big, loving Remedy welcome to Chase.
Later, while working with a lesbian clinical counselor, that I discovered a practitioner who actually used the C word. Finally, I was being acknowledged as someone who came from a history of trauma and loss resulting from colonization. I also began to see how oppression wasn't just a First Nations experience for me. There were other intersections at play, and I could now acknowledge other aspects of self, which, surprisingly, brought up the same feelings. Finding the vibrant gay community in Vancouver really helped me shed the layer of shame that had kept me isolated for so long. It honestly surprised me, the sense of freedom and happiness, just being at ease with self and finding community. My elders were accepting of my Two-Spirit identity, and Glenn told me a story of an Okanagan woman who was also Two-Spirit and was a highly revered war chief. I couldn't help but feel even more connected to culture. His elder in Espila in Washington still remembered a time before contact when not only being a woman, but gender identity and expression were healthy and thriving. Today, our communities are still recovering from the isms and obias introduced with colonization, and far too often, Two-Spirit trans people are the target of hatred. Sadly, it comes from both worlds, not just on reserve in small communities, but also when Two-Spirit trans folk escape to the city to find community only to once again encounter racism, trans, homophobia, and other challenges. I can't help but think of spawning salmon swimming upstream, fighting to reach a goal that may be unattainable. Transitioning reminds me of my struggles growing up. The feeling of vulnerability and the potential for violence are similar, only this time it's my gender, or lack thereof, not race. That is the issue for many around me. And although I have learned to temper my hypervigilance, which is a part of my PTSD, I remain acutely aware of my surroundings. The classic hallmark stares I get due to my lack of conforming to the gender binary will be with me until my body fully transitions. However, it is more subtle assaults that are difficult to see coming and that are often leaving me adult. The change in attitude of the once friendly, conversational ultrasound therapist who suddenly shifts cold and mute is suspect. Others' more hurtful actions conducted in public carry the same harsh blows as racism inflicts. I refer to this as a deer in the headlights phenomenon. Somehow, I'm always stunned and unprepared, rarely able to respond because I feel like I've been kicked in the chest. The internalized anger at myself for not immediately challenging the incident is exacerbated since I temporarily am winded and without words. The pain is deep and debilitating. There resides a level of frustration and rawness that exists below the surface that only my brothers and sisters know. It keeps the other isolated, questioning their sanity and their self-worth. It would explain the statistics around suicide for First Nations people, for trans folk, and so many others who are marginalized. And after a lifetime of constant re-injury or aggravation, a person's ability to withstand these assaults is whittled away. Sometimes, that's when they enter the healthcare system. They may be desperately in need of help, but are unwilling or resistant, especially if experience has shown them that they will be judged or worse. Only they enter the system as a last resort, the cost of not trying one last fatal time. Some 30 years later, as a retired RCMP officer, full of confidence and life experience, I'm reminded how deep those wounds are the moment I ask for help. The role of shame is a powerful and pervasive presence, even today. Advocating for self, having a voice, and being able to use it has not been an easy lesson. Asserting self and confronting an issue around healthcare is probably one of the most accurate measures of my self-worth. One of the most difficult experiences in healthcare occurred at the UBC Operational Stress Injury Clinic when I was first assessed and sought treatment for my PTSD. I was already experiencing considerable anxiety, which I tried to control with my avoidance behaviors, which I'm pretty good at. So when I sensed judgment from the practitioner early on, I began to stress over our sessions rather than the actual trauma work itself, and things began to unravel quickly. Somehow I felt in the wrong and full of self-doubt. Was it my trans identity? Was it race? I tried not to project. Whatever it was, something was undermining our sessions. I needed to advocate for herself, address the problem, and request another counselor. My resistance to rocking the boat and my fear around exacerbating the situation were grounded in previous experiences. Prior conflicts usually prove that I wasn't the one in power and that I would get hurt. The idea of putting myself out there at further risk goes against anyone's nature. Fortunately, the issue was managed effectively, and with a short period of time, I was assigned a new practitioner, Dr. Molly Bates. Yay, Molly. Surprisingly, things moved along quickly and trust was established early on. Since the presence of respect, empathy, and non-judgment in the room was palpable. I suspected that this practitioner understood that people coming from a long history with oppression have their own mechanisms and tools that they use to survive, and I am no different. Not only is my history with colonization complex, but also accumulative in nature, specifically around trauma. Grief and loss are not the same as someone coming from a nuclear family where they may not have lost a family member until they were an adult, nor suffered disconnection from community, language, or culture as a result of government policies. My faith and trust in a counselor who is capable of discussing privilege as it relates to oppression is well placed. I know I'm in good hands, and I also know that the person who sits across from me not only has done her own work, but has taken responsibility for it. I've never had to educate my practitioner on competencies around my identities, nor is it my responsibility anymore. I have expectations around respect, cultural competencies, and a shared learning environment. Active listening skills are a part of that, since it's how I know if someone is genuine or not. In general, law enforcement personnel interrupt someone speaking every 7 to 9 seconds. Quick assessment is required under certain conditions, particularly for emergency responders, so this practice is understandable within the workplace. However, certain practices that work under specific conditions do not carry over to the other, and more often than not, two cultures, whether they be First Nations, queer, trans, and yes, even policing and healthcare, usually come into conflict. There must be a mindfulness around listening and respect, which is just the beginning of the relationship. Creating safe space requires hard work, and if there's anything I know for a fact, it's that safety is absolutely essential to my wellness. As my identities are acknowledged and given a voice, only then can I move into a space beyond survival mode. In a way, it reminds me of ceremony, where under certain conditions have to be carefully prepared in order for spirit to come. It's respectful tones, the welcoming, the coming together in a way that honors the other.
I'd like to now introduce our last reader for this half of the show, because there's more. She's definitely the person, I haven't seen all of your shoes, but I'm pretty sure Amber Dawn is wearing the best shoes in the entire room. I mean, if we wanted to have a shoe off later, I'm obviously 100% in favor of that plan. Or a boot off, I'm flexible. It's another conversation. Jane and Paul, I'm sorry if that was awkward. It's my date's parents. Anyways, let's continue. Amber Dawn is laughing into the remedy. See, it's a joyful experience as much as we are dealing with complex structures of privilege and oppression. Hey-o. I remain optimistic. I really do. It's why I'm here. It's why I do this work. So Amber Dawn, in addition to having really awesome footwear with which to kick the patriarchy in some body part, is also a writer, a filmmaker, and a performance artist. She is the author of the Lambda Literary Award-winning novel Sub Rosa, the memoir How Poetry Saved My Life, which won the Vancouver Book Award, and also the poetry book Where the Words End and My Body Begins. Read them all. She is also the editor of Fist of the Spider Woman, Tales of Fear and Queer Desire, and co-editor of With a Rough Tongue, Femmes Write Porn. She has an MFA in creative writing. Her award-winning docu-porn, Girl on Girl, has been screened in 8 countries. It's in your bio. Amber Dawn was the 2012 winner of the Writers' Trust of Canada, Dana Ogilvie Pride for LGBT writers. I just wanted to say all of your accolades. It's not even a complete list. Amber Dawn, get on up here.
I just, if I started to say all the thank yous, I would use up the 10 minutes that I need to spend with you on thank yous. So I will keep it to one, and that's, I want to thank the contributors that are reading here tonight. I know, like myself, many of you wrote this piece for The Remedy under great personal risk, emotional risk, and I thank you. And I know many of you did not look at it again until you're up here on the stage reading it aloud, which is a feeling. Thank you for doing that work. Sex work solidarity is healing in 4 parts. 1, trust exercise. Once upon a time, in fact, I'm referring to 1996, but maybe the familiarity of a fairy tale intro will thwart the standard dubiety or othering that occurs when a sex worker speaks up. Othering is the means in which sex workers are rendered into makeshift statistics within countless shelved reports. Othering is how sex workers' voices are dismissed as the most current legislation governing prostitution is being passed, C-36, for example. Moreover, othering is an everyday mindset that pervasively allows negative perceptions of sex workers to be openly asserted, as in we are heteronormative family wreckers, criminals, disease spreaders, drains on the systems, victims, patriarchy perpetrators, and even some cisgender and trans queer circles see us as inconvenient obstacles to mainstream acceptance. Before I read this essay about accessing appropriate health and wellness as a sex care worker, I'm going to ask you to reflect on your own relationship to othering, perpetuating, witnessing, and surviving it, and how it has impacted your health. You're here at the Remedy launch, and if I take this as a clue, I can imagine aspects of your own identity have been ousted by the dominant mainstream, and maybe othering has literally sickened you too. Solidarity work is much more complicated than we're all in this together kind of thinking, of course. I'd like to share some personal and practical knowledge I've learned about how to solidarize with sex workers. And sex workers need close allies. Not for the sake of the argument close, not save the less fortunate close, but eye to eye close. To encourage this closeness, I will invite you to participate in self-reflection, seek and find games, holistic intervention, and yes, I'll use fairy tale phrasing. Once upon a time, in 1996, a family physician was seeing a patient for the first time. This patient disclosed that she was violently raped by a bad date while working the street, and since then she's had difficulty managing back and leg pain, sleeping, eating, concentrating. This patient said, "I've only had shitty experiences with doctors. What can you tell me that will help me trust you?" Now imagine you are that family physician or nurse, that social worker, that clinical supervisor, healthcare researcher, emergency room receptionist, frontline shelter worker, LGBTQ2S hotline volunteer, that confidant or lover or friend. What would you say to help build trust? Did you actually imagine it? What would you say to help build trust? I was wondering if you could do me a favor. It's available to you. Did any of you think that the first thing you would say is, "I believe you"? Raise your hand if you did. Yeah, thank you. That's what this doctor said to me. I'm going to move us out of the doctor's office. To be honest, I didn't want to contribute to the remedy. But because I love Zena Sharman, I was very close to her journey editing this book. And I said, well, are there any contributors that are talking about sex work? And there wasn't. It's no shortage of talent, and it's no shortage of voices. It's that decriminalization still isn't a reality for us. Our identities are criminalized. Everyone I know, everyone who's close to me, can't come out. I can't even dedicate my piece right now to other sex workers in the audience for their fear and safety of being out. So I will continue to do this work, and I really hope that you can join me in doing it. Decriminalization is a big part of my essay, and I talk about why we should all become very articulate in talking about decriminalization, how it will greatly help us be able to mobilize as healthcare providers and as sex workers in connecting. There's also lots of statistical data. There's some research. There's a resource list. But mostly what I like to do is tell personal stories. So I'm going to actually skip through all of that with the faith that you will kindly read it if you have the capacity to. And I'm going to just skip to the last part of my four-part essay. So here we go. Part four, holistic intervention. In a land far, far away. In fact, I'm referring to a recent queer dance party held in a warehouse located along one of Vancouver's last street working strolls. Like any queer dance party, a good number of partygoers, myself included, were hanging around outside to air our sweaty bodies or smoke or flirt with sweaty smokers. A gorgeous queen in Daisy Dukes sauntered over to the curb and pretended to hustle. Her friends hooted at her. My chest tightened. This party was located 6.5 blocks away from where I was violently date raped by a bad date. Some femme shouted, "No, honey, you are way prettier than the hookers around here." My temples began to ring. 3 blocks away is where Sheila Catherine Egan was last seen. 1 block away is where Jenny Firminger was last seen. I remember the names because I remember them. Sheila was 2 years younger than me. Jenny was born and raised in my hometown. Is this how they shall be spoken of? As quote-unquote ugly hookers by queer kids stopping by the stroll for a cheap place to drink and dance. "Don't you ever insult the women in this neighborhood," I say, my voice raised. Everyone around me froze. The femme eyed her friends pleadingly, like she was looking for backup. "It was just a joke," she said. I lay into her again. "Don't you ever." No blood tests can detect grief or disgrace. No research survey can quantify the harmful impact of having your queer communities, your so-called safe, inclusive spaces, other you again and again. To be othered by anti-sex worker comments or jokes stings, certainly. What cuts deeper is the other of having no one stand beside you. No one offered me a single word of solidarity in that moment, and that moment is by no means a unique example. At times, this has caused me to see other queers as potential threats to my dignity and well-being, and it has also caused me to isolate from queer communities altogether. There are always ways to intervene against othering. And when I say intervention, I'm not talking about one of those pop sensational reality shows about addiction. I'm talking about holistic and preventative care. The healing properties of allyship also cannot be measured by medical assessment, but they are equally real. And we must believe we can heal from the sickness and from the damage. Staging an intervention against othering requires some planning. The greatest care an ally might offer is simply being ready to speak up, stand up with sex workers. I'm going to offer you the following examples. A friend calls me the day before the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, which, by the way, is on December 17th, and y'all should go, and asks if I'd like her to march in the red umbrella procession with me. And should she call other friends so I have an entire posse to march with? A professor at the creative writing department, where I now work, performs a pro-decriminalization themed TEDx talk called The Red Umbrella, Sex Work, Stigma, and the Law, and forwards the YouTube link to all of our colleagues. I sit in my cubicle with awe as I read the thoughtful and affirming replies coming from nearly every professor and staff member. Being out at work has become more secure in a matter of hours. A friend joins me each year to host a fundraiser cabaret for the Missing and Women's Memorial March. Together we gather a group of queer artists who volunteer their time and talent to raise money for the Indigenous and other community elders and families of the missing and murdered women. Sometimes I keep the donation money in my bra before I hand it over to the elders just for old time's sake. My wife takes the morning off work to go to a sensitive doctor's visit with me. She says, I can wait in the lobby or I can come in the exam room. And she says, I can help you vocalize your concerns or I can just sit and support you quietly. And afterwards, she says, I can take you to that fried chicken place that you like. She says, I love you. She says, I'm with you. And that family physician from once upon a time in 1996 happens to be a lesbian doctor. After years in family medicine, she moved to a different field of care, but I see her from time to time at queer events. She greets me with professional discretion, but also undeniable warmth. I will never forget her saying, I believe you. And right now, you are all here listening to my words. I thank you for your kind attention and for your solidarity. Never forget that you too can be part of this integral healing work. Thank you.
Amber Dawn, so talented. And right? Just basically, I just love all of you, and I'm really glad you're here, which is literally not an exaggeration. So what I will say before we go into the intermission is I just specifically do want to acknowledge one organization that I have a deep and abiding love for, so much so that I literally cry during every single board meeting. I emotively joy cry. It's the Catherine White Holman Wellness Center. And so some of you may be familiar with the center. It's a holistic healthcare center for trans and gender variant folks, totally volunteer run, and it's a really beautiful, incredible space. We've got some information about the CWHWC, we all got to have an acronym, at the back of the room. So feel free to get it and look it up on the internet and like it on Facebook and all those things. Speaking of liking things on Facebook, I would also like to tell you that The Remedy is on the internet. I've had people giving me coaching, like they made me join Instagram kind of coaching. So there is a website for The Remedy. I would love you to share it with your friends. It is writetheremedy.com. And if you want to get all hashtaggy about things, why not just hashtag it The Remedy? That would be exciting for me. It's what I want. And obviously, I want you to buy the book if it is within your means. We have Ken from Little Sisters here selling the book. I also can tell you that it is on order at the Vancouver Public Library. I checked today, so put in your little hold request. And I would love for you to request it. Make sure the other libraries in your life have copies of this book. If you are a teacher or you are a student learning about healthcare or gender in some capacity, tell your professors to teach this book. I want this spell to spread.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
The gender binary, gender policing, or just want to speak your truth?
Join CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective.
This group of radio makers is all about centering the voices, issues, concerns, and experiences of women identified, transgender, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, non-binary, and gender fluid folks and allies.
Anyone can join, no experience necessary.
Like the Gender Empowerment Collective on Facebook or email volunteer at citr.ca.
Our show, Babe Waves, airs Thursdays from 5 to 6 and features music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
My name's Chris Horrific.
I always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is, without question, the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it, Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers!
On Saturday, December 10th, communities around the world recognize the culmination of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. This begins with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th, and ends with Human Rights Day, which takes place today. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., CITR is broadcasting a selection of content that speaks to gendered violence, other forms of social violence, and possible modes of resistance. You can listen to these selections online by finding them under our special broadcast page at citr.ca/radio/special-broadcast. On Saturday, December 10th, communities around the world recognize the culmination of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. This begins with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th, and ends with Human Rights Day, which takes place today. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., CITR is broadcasting a selection of content that speaks to gendered violence, other forms of social violence, and possible modes of resistance. You can listen to these selections online by finding them under our special broadcast page at CITR.ca/radio/special-broadcast.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization? Do you have something to say?
Or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quichua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary.
Unceded Airwaves airs every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we meet every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. to plan our upcoming shows.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
The Downtown Eastside Women's Arts Collective is putting on a show to raise money for their bi-weekly workshops. DEWAC is a nonprofit, volunteer-run organization that facilitates workshops for self-identified women in the Downtown Eastside. Come out to Sweet Pup Studios Saturday, December 17th to see performances from 07 Popo, Birthday Bitch, Francesca Belcourt, and Milk. For more information about the event or how to get involved, visit their Facebook page at Downtown Eastside Women's Art Collective.
So I would love for you to take your seats because we have a fantastic reading coming up next. So I am thrilled to be able to introduce you, if you have not met her before, to Kara Sivarite, who is a queer writer, artist, and designer who mainly creates comics. She's published comics, writing, and illustrations in many magazines and anthologies, including Plenitude, Drawn to Change, Graphic Histories of Working Class Struggle, Descant, Filling Station, and Briar Patch. She has an MFA in creative writing from UBC and is a member of the Graphic History Collective. She lives in Daijingid's Lingay, Queen Charlotte, and Haida Gwaii as a settler on Haida territory with her partner. And you can see more of her work at makerofnets.ca. Please welcome Kara.
Since we first met, my partner Brady talked about wanting to have top surgery, but was worried, for friends had warned him, you won't be able to do anything for weeks, button your shirt, wipe yourself, feed yourself, and I promised him that I'd take care of him. 3 years later, he had surgery, and after a few days, he didn't need much help at all. But then 8 months after his surgery, he finds a lump under his scar, so he goes back to his plastic surgeon. And the doctor asks, are you worried about this? In other words, do you think it's cancer? Brady says, no. In other words, that is a pretty dramatic conclusion since you removed almost all my breast tissue. 2 months later, he has a physical with his family doctor at the Sherbourne Health Centre, Toronto's Queer and Trans Health Clinic. He reluctantly mentions the lump because he's hesitant to bring up one more thing. His doctor takes an ultrasound and it comes back as a fibroadenoma, and she decides to look into it further. 2 weeks later, he goes back to her office for the results. I don't go because we know it is nothing. How could it be anything? The odds are against it. And there's no way that he's not on the favorable side, on the side against the possibility of it being anything. Many people have this story, the moment that they are abruptly forced into what we seem to think are the exceptions, into the no man's land between the kingdom of the well and the kingdom of the ill. Brady says, it comes back positive. The nuclei are abnormal. She's referred me to the breast clinic. But really, there's nothing exceptional about this place. There are few guides, but there are many residents, and at the time, we were just few of the more privileged of its inhabitants. But even though in our late capitalist industrial society, we've tried to push back the kingdom of the dead so we no longer accept its rule, cancer is common country. A week later, the breast clinic calls, but when we go to the appointment 2 weeks later, they tell us that they rebooked it and to come back in another 2 weeks. All that spring, I remember in that time between appointments, I would walk to my studio with thoughts, worries, fears, panic, decisions, and multiplying high above me like cumulonimbus clouds. What if it's cancer? What if he dies? Will he have to have chemo? Maybe it's nothing. It's probably nothing. If we could only create plans and possibilities, if we could only be on the other side of knowing. Meanwhile, in his body, cells are dividing, multiplying. Later, I tell my roommate and her girlfriend, both nurses, that the doctors must think that Brady's cancer case is not that urgent because they haven't been making us making us wait for so long. They look at each other and scoff with the knowledge of insiders. I wouldn't take it to mean that at all, they say. We arrive at the breast clinic full of expectations for today we will have some answers. Maybe they will take care of us or at least tell us what's going to happen next. You will need to wake in the hall, she says. You can't wait here. But I'm the patient, Brady says. Only women are allowed in the waiting room. We glance in the waiting room and there are a few women in gowns and robes, mostly sitting alone. We roll our eyes and go and wait in the hall. This is our first experience of how breast cancer treatment is so gendered in certain ways that it erases trans or any other experience of gender. When Brady is called in, we realize that the doctor is there. We are there to see as a surgeon. He doesn't say much. I will remove the lump. The clinic will call you with a surgery date. Brady asks about information on breast cancer. What about resources? And he says, Google breast cancer. Later, Brady would say that surgeons are the kind of doctors that need another doctor to knock you out their patients first. A month later, Brady goes in for surgery, and 2 weeks later, the surgeon tells us that it is definitely breast cancer, but we need to do another surgery to remove the rest of the tumor and see if it has spread to his lymph nodes. This time, we only have to wait 10 days for the next surgery, and we try to have as much fun as possible, but we're leaving on the edge of something about to happen. Certain things are sharper, and other things are hazy. Right after his second surgery, the surgeon comes into the waiting room. I think I got it all. You said that you were planning on going on vacation. Well, it looks good, so you should go. And I think we are done. This is it. The cancer is gone, and I think that maybe we've crossed the borders back to the kingdom of the well. A few days later, we go to visit our friends in Newfoundland. It happens to be Pride, and we go to the annual Pride bonfire on the beach, where we meet Dave and Tony, an almost retired couple. We talk to Dave in the dark. I talk to Dave in the dark and the bonfire light. I tell him about Brady's diagnosis, and he tells me that he's been going through treatment for multiple melanoma, a cancer of the plasma cells in the bone marrow. We talk about fear, waiting, cancer, love, and hope. Later, he checks in with Brady through his treatments. Brady calls him his queer cancer family. A week after we return, the surgeon gives us the pathology report. The margins are clear, the lymph nodes are clear, so the cancer hasn't spread. It is stage one, but it is aggressive, a grade three, and it has positive receptors for HER2 and estrogen. I'm going to refer you to the medical oncologist for further treatment. At that moment, we realized that when the surgeon said it looked good, it meant that it looked good to him surgically. He had done his job, but Brady still had to have cancer treatment. Cancer patients talk about the feeling of being bounded, of being aware of the limits of space and time, enclosed within a body that has been declared diseased and now ruled by the laws of an unfamiliar territory where time becomes a place. I felt like we were at the mercy of the cancer gods and the oncology appointment gods, and the cancer gods seemed more merciful. Brady researches trans people and cancer because when we tell people that he had cancer, they would sometimes ask, oh, is it because of his hormones? They were blaming the ill, telling him that he deserved it, that he got cancer because he is trans. He finds little research on cancer and trans people, but he does find the treatment protocols for his particular type of cancer. So when we finally meet the oncologist, we are not surprised when she says that he will have to have 4 rounds of chemo, a month of radiation, and a year of Herceptin. So when's a good time to ask you about fertility options? You should have explored this 6 months ago. We're going to get you a start on chemo, like, now. She had assumed that since we were a queer couple that she did not have to worry about us wanting to have kids. Fine, I will refer you to the fertility clinic. But like many queer couples, we had talked about how we were going to have kids. Who would carry, where would we get sperm, would our kids be genetically related to each of us, to each other, would they be mixed race or white or Chinese? So many questions. We were in our early to mid-30s, so we wanted to figure that out soon, but we didn't think we'd have a week. When we go to the fertility clinic, they offer us the cancer discount to freeze Brady's eggs, and though it is still really expensive, we decide to do it. The waiting room is full of moneyed and desperate people. Every morning before work, they come in pumped full of hormones for daily ultrasounds and blood tests. Despite the ads, the fundraisers, and the charity marathons, there's been no real substantial improvements to treatment. It is still barbaric. Cut it out, poison the shit out of it, and radiate it. Chemo literally comes from the fields of war, and the language of treatment is still steeped in the images of battle. But we do not want to be good pink ribbon soldiers marching in line, running the races, consuming pink packaged products, winning or losing the battle. We go to every appointment together. He loses all his body hair, eyelashes, nose hairs, but only half his eyebrows. Nausea, pasty mouth, lack of taste buds, painful constipation. One night he has a high fever and we end up in the ER. Later he rapidly gains weight from the steroids. The doctor says that he's kind of a side effect person. The hospital is over 100 years old, with various wings built at different times in its history. Dead-end hallways, stairways that never end where you would expect. The hospital has tried many times to try to make an assemblage of improvements, adding signs, making renovations, hiring a patient navigator, but they only were just tacked on to a faulty structure. We were forced to find our way to navigate through a hierarchical healthcare system that had been set up to deal with this next symptom, not the patient. Treatment became easier only because it became familiar, common, chatting to the other patients, joking with the oncology nurses, knowing the names of the receptionists, something of a community. These small communities, not solid or enclosed as to be disappointing or exclusive, just being and getting through. Friends to distract us, come over for food or drinks or just to hang out in the kitchen. Family. Brady's brother came to visit from Vancouver many times. Brady's mom would bus in from the suburbs and cook us soup and make us char siu and choy. Neighbors. Far away friends sent us notes, hats, rage and love. In celebration and struggle. Thank you.
The last page of Kara's piece, the community page, that's made me cry on more than one occasion just as part of the editing process in terms of thinking about, again, the power of community and how we do have the capacity and do care for one another. Next up, I want to welcome Faiza Bundali. She's a femme South Asian writer. She is a somatic therapist and often works at the intersections of chronic illness and disability, intergenerational trauma and resilience, and spirit. She is a teacher in training with generative somatics and was an artist in residence with Sins Invalid. And very important for this time of year, she is very much a Scorpio. Please welcome Faiza.
Well, I can't see you at all, so that's maybe a relief. So I have lived with illness with chronic illness for about 15 years. And if I were to offer you a nugget, it would be that illness is a potent state of body. And from a state of illness, some things are possible that are not otherwise possible. And because some of us are sick, there is offering to the community, or things are forwarded in the community that would not otherwise be forwarded. And that's a good thing for all of us. And this culture we have of isolating and discarding people who are sick, if we really understood what the offer was, we wouldn't do that. We would make a different move. And I'm for that future. I call it in. I imagine we all do. Through the body. I'm 21, and my throat is swollen and sore. It's an ordinary moment, feels like any other sickness. I don't even remember it clearly. And yet, I'm crossing a threshold into what will begin 7 years of bone-deep exhaustion, loneliness, sharpened intuition, losing language. I am at this moment athletic, a runner and a climber. I am a straight-A student, and every academic door has opened for me. I am also insecure. Later, I will connect this to being brown, to being a child of immigrants, to being queer. I will learn words like internalized racism and homophobia that will make sense of the way I feel small. I crave belonging secretly, like a prize I could never win and do not even name. My family doctor tells me I have mono. 1 year later, when I am still sick, she will say I have chronic fatigue syndrome. I have no idea that I am about to dissolve, that I will reconstitute differently on the other side of this threshold so ordinary I do not even notice myself crossing over. I withdraw from classes, move in with my parents. I lie in bed. I muster the energy to shower and return to rest. I muster the energy to eat and return to rest. My brain is full of sensation, lost to thought. My legs are full of ache. I have not completed the trajectory, not accomplished the successes that I thought made me good. Instead, I am listening closely to my body. Yes, no, how much? I become well enough to walk outside and do so slowly, rest on every bench, carry sunglasses and a book, nap everywhere. Over time, almost every friend drops away and I let them go. Even phone calls are most often too much. I grow a loneliness that will be difficult to shake, even years later, even when I hear daily from partner, from family, from friends, how dearly I am loved. The first time I am well enough to walk outside, I see a poster advertising the work of a medical intuitive. I call her, and she becomes my first mentor in this strange landscape through which I have no map. She tells me about intergenerational trauma, how it is carried in my body, how I have directed my anger inwards and the seams are blowing open. I learn about the impacts of displacement, how racism over generations has made my body vulnerable. This healer has also been sick and has learned through her body. She speaks to me and knows, as only one who has gone before can. Illness sensitizes my body to spirit. It is a gateway through which some of us walk between worlds. When I am crashed out, when every muscle of my back contacts the mattress and I do not have the strength or stamina to sit up, some dial on my connection to spirit turns up. I have vivid dreams, see things that do not have physical form, and have sudden knowings. I also have a visceral sense of well-being that cannot be shaken by my state of illness. One such night, it is suddenly necessary to tell my first queer crush and closest friend that I love her. I will not heal unless I do. In the morning, more rested, I decide this is irrational, and besides, I have a boyfriend. When I gather the courage 2 years later and too late to win her, I learn that acknowledging queer desire is needed at the center of my healing. On another such afternoon, my older cousin, who has died some years earlier, keeps me company as I heat my lunch. He was my steady teammate through childhood summers of playing outside. That afternoon, I am weak with fatigue, and he's there, steady. I am 35 and have opened a somatic therapy practice. My work grounds in my body, connection with spirit, and the teachings of my mentors. Somatics rebuilds connection to the body and sensation as avenues of knowing and healing. It's life-affirming towards the all of it that life is. Healing through the body is not a neutral choice. The felt sensation of fatigue lays me flat. Chemical toxicity in my tissues curls me up. Increasing connection to my body requires feeling into the full range of what's there. Illness has been my heavy-handed invitation into transformation, necessitating close listening, opening to spirit, integrating ancestral trauma while envisioning new futures, requesting and accepting allyship, and repeated surrender to what is. These skills translate directly to facilitating healing work. Many who live or have lived with chronic illness make critical contributions to collective healing. Through illness, I have decomposed and regrown different to know, finally, that a life that includes chronic illness is as deeply necessary as any other, as worthy of belonging, as important to our collective freedoms. Thank you.
Just love that. Faiza, thank you so much. Last but not least, we have a caped poet, which just really feels both magical and super hero-ish, which I like on so many levels. Just like I like you on so many levels, Esther McPhee. Esther is a writer, a magic maker, and a collective organizer who grew up on Stolo Land and now lives on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Land in Vancouver, where they earned an MFA in creative writing from UBC. Their writing has appeared across North America. Esther likes poetry. See, I just wanted to say pop music because that's the second thing, because I associate you so strongly with One Direction and the Backstreet Boys, among others. Let me start that over. Esther likes poetry, all caps, pop music, and scavenging for berries. They're one half of the organizing team behind Reverb, a queer reading series, which is so wonderful and so amazing, and is happening on November 24th, right next Thursday, at Gallery Gachet. So please go to that, because it's just the best. And you can also visit Esther online at esthermcphee.com. Please welcome Esther.
Well, I did wear my cape up here because it was so cold, but it's actually really warm up here. Very cozy. First, I just want to say thank you. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Zena, for creating this book and putting on this event. And thank you so much to all of the readers who've come before me. It's really an honor to get to be part of your little crew tonight. Feels very special. So I'm going to read some poems. I'm actually really warm. I'm going to take off my cape and put it on this chair. So I'm going to read three poems, one of which is in this book that hopefully you've all picked up. And that's that. So this first poem, I just want to give you a heads up for feelings about gender that you might have or you might not, but if you do, you're warned. And this poem, I like to say, I've read it a couple times before, so you might have heard it, and you might have heard this preamble, but I like to say that this poem is about the impossible and kind of unconditional love that we carry for our families, whatever they may be. So for me, this is a poem for all of the beloved trans and gender variant people in my life, including myself. And it's called What Love Can't Do. It's this endless orchestral ache, like the bow never lifts from the violin strings, the note held taut. You, transplant, no matter what city or song, the enormity of what I wish I could offer you, an ocean streaming from my hands. I will love you across all landscapes. across names, pronouns, your shape shifting or not. I'll love you so much that something will heal, the scars you didn't choose smoothed back into skin. The scars you did choose worn to the beach. Let's take them swimming. I will love you enough that you'll be able to walk into the water again, the way you haven't in years, salt crash and tug on your body. How long has it been since you were so young you could have been swept away by the tide? I will love you until the tide changes and we're all swept backwards, your mother calling you into the house instead of telling you to leave it. Poems are funny after like non-poem pieces because people never know if they should clap after a poem, so. So you should. Actually, you technically shouldn't, but I like it if you do. So thank you. So the last poem that I'm going to read is in The Remedy, so I'm going to read it from The Remedy because it's a very official feeling. This is called, I was going to say Heads Up for Health, but like, come on. Come on. So this is called Waiting on Information from Doctors. Oh, no, I do want to say one thing about it, actually, which is just that I wrote this at this time last year when I had the kidney infection that, like, never ended. And it's really nice to be able to read it out loud at a seasonally appropriate time. So all of the seasonal markers, you don't even have to imagine. They're real. It's called Waiting on Information from Doctors. You keep the phone nearby. Read over requisition forms at the kitchen table. Steal an hour outside where the world smells like rosemary and damp cedar, lit up green with rain, until your body sends you to bed again. Out of breath, as if the wind went right through you, the way it shakes the last gold leaves pinned against a cloudy spread of gray. You roll over and over on the bedspread, turn the sun on, in a flicker of yellow through the window, then off. Whole weeks pass by you like you're in a time lapse. Every frame captures you in a different sprawl. Now curled under a blanket, now with a book propped against your knees, now tapping out a nonsense rhythm on the wall. Except it all happens in real time until you're bored out of your mind and your body says, exactly, get out of your mind. It doesn't care that you can't go to work. Your body's occupied with its own work, translating microbial movement into pain, which is a language you should have studied better when you were younger because you don't understand now what your body is trying to tell you. Your body doesn't understand money. If it did, it would sure as hell expect to get paid for all this sweat and drudgery. Your body doesn't know how to count. Not like you do, 5 days wasted on sleep and movies and bad songs on repeat. Then 10 days, 20, 30. Then it's better to stop counting, like your body said to, in the first place. At least it never says, I told you so. Your body's not worried, even if you are. It's satisfied with the snatch of blue sky that appears through the glass late in the afternoon, wants only to be well enough to go touch the tangle of nasturtiums still growing strong in the garden. Your body puts up with your obsession with what the doctors might tell you, even if it can't puzzle out why you need all these words anyway. How many times around will it take for you to realize they don't have information for you? Not the kind you want. Not the kind that gives you back what you think you've lost. Your body hasn't lost anything, is still a blazing